Accession number 8702, rule number 1.
Mrs. Owen, tape 1. Mrs. Owen, could I ask you something about your life prior to the outbreak of war? What was your situation then? And, you know, you obviously would have been a schoolgirl, is that right?
Yes,
about
I was.
1939.
Oh, 39?
Yes.
Back in 30. I was at school in Lewes in Sussex at Scythover Manor School. And my father was in Baghdad at the time. And then I left that school in 1940 to go out to South Africa because we were trying to join him in Japan. He'd been posted to Japan. And my mother was given a choice of either Canada or South Africa for getting a Japanese ship. And as she'd been to South Africa before, in case we were held up, she selected South Africa because she had friends there. But in fact, we stayed in South Africa over a year, nearly 2 years.
How easy was it getting to South Africa in wartime?
Very easy. You just got in a boat and went in a convoy and hoped you weren't going to be torpedoed. And if you were me, you were an arrant coward, so you kept on saying, please, Mummy, is there going to be a torpedo tonight? You know, but
where did you get on this ship in the convoy? Can you remember?
Liverpool.
What was the atmosphere in Liverpool like at the
There was a
dockside?
Great raid going on at the time. And we were on board, so we could just see the Liver building sort of lit up. And it was very, very noisy. I mean, tremendous gunfire. And I think we sailed more or less, we sailed late at night, and I think more or less in the middle of the raid. But we'd been in Liverpool about a day and a bit.
What was your experience of the war before you left for South Africa? Had you been involved with other raids?
No, I was at school in Scythover Manor, and that was evacuated to Firle Place because it was right by the Brighton railway line. And it was thought in those days that enemy aircraft followed railway lines. So we were evacuated to Firle Place, which was inland. And we were there for 2 terms. And then I left to go out to South Africa with a view to going on to Japan.
When you left Liverpool, it must have been quite frightening for a young child on this convoy.
Well, I have honestly have no further recollection of it beyond that though. I mean, yes, it was quite frightening, but you sort of stayed with the other ships and you took great comfort from seeing the other ships. And we were very lucky because as soon as you get a certain distance of the way, you were going to be all right. I mean, by the time you got to the equator, you weren't going to... I can't remember the geography of it, but there was a point at which the captain of our ship said, well, we're now more or less U-boat free.
Did you have any scares on the way?
I can't remember any. I can't remember. There may have been, but I can't honestly remember.
Were there many other civilians on your ship?
Yes, it was full of them. So it wasn't a troop ship. It was full of people, I presume, people being evacuated.
So it was Glasgow, not Liverpool?
Yes, it was Glasgow, and it was August the 3rd, 1940. And it was the Union Castle Line, Winchester Castle.
I see. Yes. What happened to you in South Africa? Did you have any relatives or friends there?
My mother had a lot of friends because my father had been with the Governor General in 1928 to about 32.
Yes. What was your father's position exactly? Was he in the Foreign Office?
He was a diplomatic service, which now doesn't exist. I mean, now it's all called foreign service, but diplomatic service was as distinct from the consular service.
How long were you in South Africa before you went on to Japan? Over a year, yes. I see. And you went to school there, didn't you?
Yes, I went to school. I got myself into a convent because at first I'd had a governess who we took out with us. Or who came out, because my mother wasn't very much into education anyway. She thought as long as girls had governesses, that was quite sufficient. And I got sick of this, because I, in fact, wanted to be a doctor. And so I put myself into a convent, where I was at least 3 or 4 terms, as I remember. And before we went out to Japan.
Yes. Could you now tell me about your journey to Japan?
Well, that was all... My father... We'd had a telegram, I think, to say that my father was very ill. He'd had a kidney infection, and he was not expected to live. He had an abscess on a kidney, that's right. And he was not expected to live. But, I mean, there were no planes going out there. And so my mother literally packed up everything at very short notice. And we got onto a Dutch cargo passenger ship called the Tegelberg. And we went from Cape Town to Durban via Madagascar. We didn't stop at Madagascar because that was Vichy France owned. But we sighted a submarine, which was all quite exciting. But, I mean, we literally just sighted it. It didn't do anything. It was a Vichy France one, and I think probably a rather incompetent submarine because it didn't attempt to torpedo us or do anything. It just sort of looked at us, and we looked at it. And I know the Dutch captain, who was sort of free Dutch, said he was going to transmit on the wireless where it could be caught again or something. And we went to the Philippines where we left the Tegelberg, and we went to the, I suppose, I don't know, I don't think it was an embassy in the Philippines, where whatever it was that the British had there, to find that there were wild telegrams trying to stop this mad English woman and her daughter going east when everybody wanted us to go west, because it was just beginning to look very bad with Japan. But my mother absolutely got the bit between her teeth, and she was not going to be stopped. She hadn't seen my father for 2.5 to 3 years, so she was frantic to get there, if only to a deathbed sort of thing. Actually, by this time, we knew that he was out of hospital, because they'd had a telegram to say he was much better, which they used as ammunition to make us try and retrace our steps.
But who were these people trying to make you change your mind?
The Foreign Office. I mean, literally just the ordinary personnel department of the Foreign Office. We were being told that we were a nuisance. And we were a nuisance. I mean, a 45-year-old woman and a 16-year-old girl turn up and we were a frightful blight. I mean, the last thing they wanted, if suddenly Philippines were going to be invaded, what were they going to do with 2 more mouths to feed? I mean, we were a nuisance. But then we got on to we caught a Japanese ship at Manila, which was an enormously luxurious liner, which took us to Kobe. And at Kobe, my father met us. He'd had a sort of miraculous recovery, because he was so thrilled, my mother. Mind you, about 8 weeks had elapsed, so he had had time, geographically, to get better, you know. I mean, chronologically, he'd had time to get better. But then we arrived the beginning of November.
What was your first impression of Japan? Were you rather excited to be going to that area of the world?
Yes, I was. My first impression was the house was filled with the biggest chrysanthemums I'd ever seen, absolutely enormous, all smelling sort of bittersweet smoke smell. They were absolutely wonderful, but they were quite the biggest I've ever seen. They were huge, and it is the national flower. And we arrived in, I think, November, which is the chrysanthemum month.
You were saying, you know, what other impressions were there apart from these gorgeous chrysanthemums?
It was a very nice house, quite a modern, for those days, it was a very modern house.
Would this be in Tokyo?
This was in Tokyo, in the embassy compound, because all the embassies of all the countries, they had a compound. And you had, in our case, there was the ambassador's residence, which was a huge and palatial house. And the ambassador was Sir Robert Craigie. And he and his wife lived in great splendour with masses of servants and sort of white coats and all looking very smart. And then there was the Chancery building that the actual work went on in. And then there were the three councillors' houses, which was the Japanese councillor, the commercial councillor, and the councillor of embassy. And my father was the councillor of embassy. They had the next three biggest houses. Then there were the secretaries' houses. I think there were about five or six of those. And then anybody else employed there lived outside the embassy compound, where the compound was all walled and was guarded by Japanese police exactly the same way as embassies in London here are guarded by British police, which is sort of standard form for embassies abroad.
When you were inside the compound, were you conscious of being sort of shut in at all at that time?
Well, at that time we weren't shut in. I mean, we were free to come and go.
But were you conscious of having this sort of wall surrounding you?
Well, no, because you had nice big gardens. It was quite a large area.
And it was just British people inside this
Only,
compound?
Only, yes.
The French would have had their own.
In the compound, and the Americans had their compound.
Were you aware at all at that time, Mrs. Owen, of the war situation, you know, as a young 16-year-old girl?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, there was a... I wish I could remember the name. Tojo. Yes, I have remembered the name. General Tojo, I think, was the Japanese Foreign Secretary. And they were at a great stage of passing notes, increasingly rude notes to each other. I mean, the British government and the Japanese government. Because there was obviously whatever they were negotiating about, which I don't remember, was falling down. And presumably they were negotiating not to fight. But then I think halfway, people like my father almost half hoped that war would be declared, without actually saying so, because it was thought that this would be the one thing to bring in the Americans, because the Americans had more Far Eastern interests than we did.
Did you actually hear that expressed by people in the
embassy? I think I must have done. Or I don't know, quite honestly, whether I've said that now, sort of 45 years on, or... No, I think I must have heard it expressed. Quite honestly, I think I must have heard it expressed.
So you were aware of activity?
Oh, Lord, yes. We were very much aware that we were lucky to get there. And we were only there, I think it was something like less than 10 days before war actually was declared.
What was the atmosphere like in the embassy, you know, apart from this increased activity? Were you aware that people were conscious of the vulnerability of their situation?
No. No, I don't remember them feeling particularly vulnerable, because we all thought that we'd be evacuated the second war was declared. Because, according to the Geneva Convention, diplomats are evacuated within 24 hours. So we all thought that we'd be out within minutes.
So you felt relatively secure, did you?
Oh, yes.
Did you have a chance to get into Tokyo before war was declared and see something of the life?
No, not particularly. I don't remember particularly going in. We went to ordinary shops and things, but we were allowed out after war had actually been declared, and when we were already in the compound, we were allowed out. because for some extraordinary reason the Japanese thought highly of going to the dentist, and if you could sort of say that you really desperately needed dental fillings, you were taken to the dentist. And I had rows and rows of my lower teeth filled with most advanced fillings, which absolutely fascinated British dentists when I got back. And that was wonderful, because you could sort of evade your detectives, who weren't all that keen. And I popped into a bookshop. I remember buying The No Plays of Japan by Arthur Whaley in a Japanese bookshop. Actually, that was, what, 3 or 4 months into the war. Then we were all brought back, and we were let out of the embassy also to watch, to look at the cherry blossom when it was at its height. We were taken to a Buddhist cemetery when the cherry blossom was at its height, because they wanted to strike the analogy between the samurai warrior who fell in his prime, like the cherry blossom did. And we were told this through interpreters, that we were to liken the cherry blossom to samurai warriors. In other words, what a rough enemy we were up against, was the idea. You know, fear was unknown, and Bushido was the thing.
Perhaps I could ask you now about the declaration of war. Can you remember the day this happened, and what your reaction was? Where were you when you heard about the war?
I was in bed. It was a Monday morning, and I was going to start school at the Sacred Heart Convent in Yokohama. And I woke up with somebody knocking, banging on the door, and I thought was the armour. And I said, come in. It was a very frightened and nervous little Japanese policeman who said, excuse me, please, there is war. You get dressed bloody quick. So I did, to find that my parents also had a policeman in their bedroom, but we were allowed to go downstairs. I mean, it was quite all right. And because of international convention, they weren't shutting the gates until later in that day. So we all dashed off to the Chancery building to tear up and crumple up and incinerate secret documents.
They allowed you to do that, didn't
they? Oh, yes. Well, because the Japanese in London were allowed to do it, too. All our counterparts in London were living in enormous luxury in the Dorchester Hotel. No trouble at all. Having a splendid time.
Did you participate in that, tearing up the documents?
Yes, oh, yes.
Can you tell me what you remember of it?
I don't remember very much, except we were sort of literally given huge files and told to tear them up and crumple them, and then they were all put into bags and taken away and burnt in an incinerator. And we just did that the whole of that day.
And the Japanese left you alone while you were doing it?
Yes. And people were coming in from the outside all that day.
These would have been English people?
English people, yes. I mean, typists, language officers. Also, there were dozens of people. I mean, I think perhaps only 30 or 40 people lived in the embassy compound, if that many. I mean, well, it was only about 8 officers with their families and their servants, because there was a servants' village in the embassy compound where all the servants lived. And so all the people who came in from outside were anxious to bring in, well, the consul and the consul general. The consul general didn't live in, for instance, and all their staffs.
Had you heard about Pearl Harbor at this stage?
Yes, I think we had. I can't be sure, but I think we must have done. I think we knew about Pearl Harbor.
What was the reaction of your father and his contemporaries to the war with Japan? You were saying earlier how you felt they rather hoped that this would happen because it was in the Americans.
I do remember them saying, you know, that that's brought in the Americans, and that was good. That's why I think I thought, I mean, definitely everybody said that America was now at war. So that's why I think we must have known about Pearl Harbor. But then Pearl Harbor was claimed as being a great victory, which after all, from the Japanese point of view, it was. It was a victory. I mean, they practically decimated the Japanese fleet, the American fleet. And as far as I remember, my father and the ambassador were all sort of conferring all that day. So I don't remember seeing them very much.
Could you now tell me about the internment? You were saying the gates weren't closed immediately because these people were coming in.
Well,
have you any idea how many people did come in before they were closed?
Yes, we were all together. We were 89. And then I think we were 91 by the time we were repatriated because two people had babies. But I can't remember very much about their having babies beyond the fact that everybody was very angry with them for having them. It was considered very inconvenient and a thoughtless thing to do. But there was not a lot they could do about that. I mean, they were already on the way by the time war was declared, so it really wasn't thoughtless of anybody. But I can't remember what time the gates were locked, I'm sorry, but I remember two or three people came in over the wall after that, and I did see, actually, one man, enormously fat man, from the British Council called Hawley, climbing over the wall, which was an unusual sight. And his wife was Japanese, and she was taken away to prison straight away. The same day, she was imprisoned. And he came over the wall. I think about half a dozen people came in over the wall afterwards, because the wall was enormous and they couldn't keep the whole of it under surveillance.
How did your life change then, once the gates were shut and you were now internees?
Well, our houses, for instance, we all had to put up people from the outside so that I didn't have my own bedroom anymore. I slept on a sofa for a bit. And then I remember sleeping on a balcony for a bit. Because it was, I can't remember, I think we had 9 extra people in our house. But I can't remember much about it, quite honestly, who they were or what.
Presumably, there would have been quite a mixed group of internees, would they, sexes and age-wise?
Oh, yes. There were... I remember one couple. We had a vice-consul called Cowley, who had a quite impossible Russian wife, who was forever having hysterics about everything. And she always swore that the food was poisoned. I remember my father and Mrs. Cowley had a sort of running battle throughout the entire time. I mean, mealtimes became a sort of purgatory because one never knew what sort of tantrum Mrs. Cowley was going to have. And she could never eat the food, and she was a thoroughly tiresome and difficult woman. And I think every house had those sort of difficulties in them, with various people sort of being shut up in too close contact with each other, but it didn't bother me because I just found it exciting. The main thing was that I'd suddenly discovered I'd left school.
What sort of freedom of movement did you have within the embassy compound? Were you allowed to wander at will, you know, between the houses?
Oh, yes. After the first day, as I remember, we had a detective between my mother, father and myself, who was so keen on his work, he even came to the loo with you and sat on the edge of the bath with his back to you, which was very off-putting. But then the detectives got embarrassed by this and they stopped doing it because they obviously hated the whole thing. So eventually, having had very keen detectives, the detectives all disappeared because instead of having detectives, they decided to swear our servants into the Kempe police. So the servants you knew listened to every single word you said. And also, I remember they had put microphones into a lot of the wall switches, which must have been very advanced technology when you think about it. because I know that if ever anybody was going to say anything slightly dubious, we used to pick up a cushion and walk over to the light switch and cover the light switch with the cushion before saying whatever it was you were going to say that was thought to be of interest. Up and sort of, if somebody said, I can't think what sort of thing, oh, that a servant had been seen doing something, or a servant had been seen talking to somebody over the wall, or something like that. You know, you used to pick up your cushion and sort of to deaden the sound. But it must have been very advanced technology that they could get microphones into, and I do remember they did bug all the houses.
Did your relations with the servants change because of this?
No, not at all.
Were you friendly with them?
Yes, very. I mean, they were frightfully friendly with us. I mean, our ama, she was called Aktu-san, and I remember she was frightfully matey. She gave me a little red lacquer ring as a sort of keepsake for, I think, my birthday or something, and I wore it for years.
But nonetheless, you think they worked loyally for the Japanese government?
Oh, I think they were too frightened to be anything but loyal.
And had you said something indiscreet, you think they would have reported?
Oh, I'm sure they would. Yes, because I think the penalty of not being loyal was much worse. I mean, we couldn't give them any penalties it was, after all, practically a dictatorship. And I think the penalty was probably death or something for not reporting anything, and the fear of being found out was so great.
But you managed to maintain your good relations with them, despite the fact.
Oh, yes. I mean, whenever Mrs. Cowley grumbled about the food, you know, the cook boy went off to try even harder. And he had very sort of limited rations, because all our food, our food was organised by the mother of one of the vice-consuls who happened to be staying on a visit, a Mrs. Mason, who was a formidable old trout. She really was. And she ordained that she was put in charge of food after about one day.